Good afternoon. All right, Charles and I are going to try to do something which is, I guess, slightly interactive. We'll see how it works. And this actually, this whole thing may have turned out to be a narcissistic error, but on the other hand, what you're seeing being presented here is a 25-year, quarter of a century development of an attempt to do what we would consider to be activist research. And it's been full of all kinds of contradictions. It is very deeply rooted both in the Nicaraguan and the Central American context, particularly that of the Caribbean coast. But it's also very, very personal odyssey, as Galio started to point out, and as I'm sure will become clear as Charlie and I try to go through this. I think, that what we're going to try to do is to point out or to try to go through some of the kinds of ways in which we've attempted to do what we call activist research, but to really point out the kind of deep contradictions that exist in trying to do this kind of work. I think my emphasis is going to be more on the political contradictions that exist, and they're grave, as you'll find out. And I think Charlie is going to try to point out some of the contradictions that exist in trying to be an activist researcher on the one hand, and also be a member of an academic community, and also and try to earn a living and exist in academia on the other. So from there, I'll pick up this story more or less from where Galio leads off. CIDCA, the Centro de Investigación y Documentación de Costa Atlántica, was an organization founded more or less by Galio and the Revolutionary State, which Charlie and I were recruited to participate in from about late 1981. So we're talking 25 years ago, more than 25 years ago. And actually, the three of us have had a 25-year relationship in trying to do this kind of thing, which is a long time. Maybe too long, but we'll see at the end of this. For those of us who are coming to Nicaragua to do this kind of work, I was had just received my PhD in social anthropology and a master's in marine biology. Charles was just gotten out of Harvard, so you can identify who the hippies and the nerds were in the previous presentation. And the attraction of Nicaragua was that this was a revolutionary situation in which people were staking their lives on engaging in radical social change. And not only that, but we're doing so from a perspective of scientific socialism, in which science or rationality was supposed to be the basis for the kinds of changes that would be implemented in a society for the greater social good. And so for social scientists who weren't particularly interested in science for science's sake, and who were very much interested in science or learning or research for social change, it seemed like an ideal situation. So I, for one, enthusiastically came down and rooted around until Galio hired me and began working in solidarity with the revolutionary state. Now, doing research in a revolutionary context is a very invigorating set of circumstances. One feels like one is, you know, righteous in one's work and that it's really going to have an important impact. But of course, every situation is contradictory. The revolutionary state was profoundly contradictory. Galio pointed out some of the contradictions in terms of different tendencies, et cetera, et cetera. But in the Caribbean coast of Central America, as Maricela's presentation pointed out, the inherent contradictions, cultural, racial, et cetera, that existed between the Pacific coast of the country and the Caribbean coast of the country, and the revolutionary state's rootedness in the Pacific coast and the mestizo reality, made for immediate and very grave contradictions in terms of our participation as allies of the revolutionary state within the communities of the Caribbean coast. And Galio alluded to this earlier. So here we are, supposedly doing the good work for the revolution and finding that the good work for the revolution is not necessarily such good work for the black and indigenous communities of the Atlantic coast. So contradiction one emerges, and as Galileo pointed out, we ended up trying to have to do somehow both. Trying to fortify the revolution from a critical perspective. And walking that tightrope was a very difficult thing to do, which ended both of us up in various kinds of states of rejection from both black and indigenous communities on the one hand, and from the revolutionary state on the other hand, in the midst of a war. Because if you remember, the 1980s was a war brought on by the United States, similar to Bush's predecessor, etc., etc. So there's contradiction number one. But the contradictions, actually, in terms of trying to do what we would, or what I would call activist research, became even more problematic once the revolution ended. And ended it did. As you'll remember, in 1990, the Sandinistas made the mistake of acceding to the pressures of the Western world to be democratic and got their behinds voted out of power. So in 1990, a reactionary state apparatus was placed in power. Those of us who had the wherewithal to get out of there and come to greener pastures did. Both Charlie and I got out of Nicaragua. I ended up here at the University of Texas. Charlie will tell you his own story. And this is when my truly academic life began. Now, I had always wanted to avoid academia because it seemed to me that knowledge for knowledge's sake was not knowledge worth having or using or seeking. But I had a family to feed, and I had middle-class aspirations, and so I took this particular position here at the University of Texas, and then looked around for ways to both be an academic and also simultaneously continue to engage in the kind of research still in Central America that had some, that corresponded in some way or was in solidarity with indigenous and black peoples of the Caribbean coast of Central America. But this, as you might imagine, is fraught with contradiction. The first problem is that the kinds of research that I had been doing in Nicaragua on this knife edge, you know, poised between the black and indigenous communities of the coast and the revolutionary state, transplanted to a place like University of Texas, lost all its political meaning. It's no longer grounded in the kinds of politics, cultures, social movement, et cetera, from where it came. And so if you read the conclusion of my book or the epilogue, this is one of the things that's the most contradictory about, or not the most, but it's a really contradictory aspect of my academic production. So I'm writing about a situation that no longer exists, no longer has political meaning, and still trying to remain kind of politically righteous in terms of what I'm doing. Worse yet, in some way, I don't want to be too negative, as I continued, or as we continued to look around to see how we could remain kind of politically connected to the struggles of black indigenous people in the Caribbean, coast of Nicaragua, we began to see, and Galileo helped us to see this, that there are other kinds of struggles that we could become engaged in. So this is the kind of, the not even the beginning, the neoliberal move in Central America, and we're talking about the early 1990s, is in full swing. And part of what characterized the neoliberal move in Central America was the emergence of what Charlie calls neoliberal multiculturalism, in which, as part of the democratization that's supposed to be taking place, as neoliberal reforms are being forced on Central America, the recognition of minority peoples, black and indigenous, is a key aspect. In other words, the United States, USAID, the World Bank, et cetera, are pushing these countries to adopt or open up their markets, but they're simultaneously pushing them to become democratic in certain kinds of ways. One is democratic reforms of elections, but another is the recognition of these indigenous rights, indigenous and black rights, which is the basis in some ways for the reemergence or the emergence of new social movements based on racial and ethnic identities, cultural identities. In that kind of context, the World Bank, the IMF, USAID, etc., are pushing the local governments of Central America to recognize the rights of these black and indigenous people. So as part of a $40 million project that the World Bank has in Nicaragua, as an example, the World Bank forces Nicaragua to take about $300,000 of that to devote to looking into the rights of black and indigenous peoples for communal lands. And it's there where the old soldiers of the revolutionary state, Sitka, take a organization which had been mainly used to launder money for Sitka during the time of the blockade against the Sandinistas, which is CARP, and reinvent it as a tool for social change, but a tool for social change which is now no longer operating in a revolutionary context, but is operating within a neoliberal context and trying to exploit the crevices, the spaces that neoliberalism provides to try to help to empower black and indigenous communities. In that context, we, CARP, win a contract opened up by the World Bank to identify the communal lands of black and indigenous peoples in Nicaragua. So there are the contradictions. We go from 3 or 4 years earlier to working for the revolution with revolutionary state to 3 years later, 4 years later, taking World Bank money to do work on the black and indigenous communal lands in the same area and re-enter as international consultants to do that work. Now, how can we justify that? Well, the way we justify it is we're doing participatory work, and we tried to do that. We tried to ally ourselves with the social movements in the Atlantic Coast. We allied ourselves with Sitka, which was still existing at the time. We worked with black and indigenous, black and Miskito investigators. We tried to subvert the process in any way possible, and I think we did some innovative things. So, for example, the Miskito investigators, researchers who are working with us, we've been hired to map the lands of 120 different black and Miskito communities in the coast. They were able to, working with the communities, come up with the idea not of individual communal titles, but blocks and territories as a way of claiming the entire Atlantic coast as an indigenous and black area. It was innovative, it was different, but it's still operating within the context of the World Bank and within the context of neoliberalism. Because on the one hand, we're attempting to have these communities be able to get titles for the land, their land, which are being threatened by capitalism and mestizo campesinos coming in and burning down the forests and big Taiwanese companies looking for grants to turn the forest into pulp. But on the other hand, what the World Bank wanted to do was to give these folks title to these lands, albeit communal title, but title which would allow these communities to negotiate with international capital and put these lands on the world market, at least in terms of their exploitation. Profoundly, profoundly contradictory. Gerald, you want to say anything about that?
No, I think you said it all.
I said it all. All right. Let me. We went on to do other projects. We did a similar kind of project in Honduras, also funded by the World Bank. We tried to learn as many lessons as we could from the Nicaraguan situation and to empower local Rifna and Miskito popular grassroots organizations in terms of doing the work and defining the work and defining the products of the work. But the point is that one of the most serious contradictions about doing activist work, particularly activist work which is not work in your own community, in your own space, within your own context of politics, is that one, it can only really be work in solidarity with social movements. And two, it has to, or I guess it does. It has to take place in the context of the prevailing politics and economics of the situation of the period. And so we started out, I think, as revolutionary researchers and ended up as activist neoliberal researchers. I'm not sure.
Try to use that because there's lots of stuff.
What should I use?
Yeah, I'll try to use it.
Hold it here. Okay.
Sorry.
Activist. All right. Well, I've gone from being a white liberal from Harvard to a neoliberal. I had no idea I was going to be outed in so many ways here, and I also I'll say a few things that I didn't plan to say, just kind of building on what's been said, and then I think we're probably running pretty short on time, so I'll be quick about the last part. I'm a few years younger than these guys, and I guess that was a real advantage in terms of the time that I entered into this whole mess. I was just finished an undergraduate degree, and the way I learned to do research was in this activist research context. It was really the only kind of first real lesson that I had. So it became the kind of the starting point for everything that when I went back to graduate school, I already had an idea of a very different way of doing research than would be taught in graduate school. And I can remember from early on, you know, this kind of combination of the sort of the urgency of the political moment with, you know, the dog-eared copy of Gramsci and Walter Rodney and various other texts that we were trying to read and figure out what on earth was going on. So it was a sense of real connection between theoretical thinking and very, very engaged in the moment politics, which I always found, which I've seen to me to be a very exciting and really the way that learning takes place. And I guess to build a little bit off what Ted was saying, I think one of the reasons why, from my perspective, we've stuck together working on this kind of thing for so long is, I was going to say it's his sensibility, although I suppose at this point it's mine too. It's a supreme sense of the contradictions of political processes, and there was so many kind. We've just scraped the surface. Really, there were also contradictions among the three of us that we could get into at a different moment. But there were all kinds of contradictions. When I first got there, both of them thought I should go home as quickly as possible. but combined with somehow, you know, a sense of unjustifiably high kind of ideals for what kind of change is possible in the world, and how you can live with the combination of those two for so long, I don't know. But that's always been, and I think it's something that's definitely followed us back to Texas. And that's what I was going to talk about. The third little autobiographical point, which this little story of Galios was. I know it's the first time it's ever been stated publicly. I've never told anyone about that incident, and when it happened, it was a little later than what Galios was saying. It was 1988. It was when I was already been there a number of years, and being kicked out of Nicaragua under the conditions that we were working was so embarrassing, chagrining, traumatic for me that I couldn't imagine even how to write about it. I never said it to anyone. I don't know many people now. I know a lot of people. Everyone in the room. But I'm not saying this. I don't want to overdramatize it. But I think the way it connects with something that I did want to say today is that I was profoundly depressed by it having happened. It happened because of a deepening relationship that I had with the Miskito communities that I was working with that were in rebellion against the Siamese's. But one of the consequences is that I ended up writing my dissertation, which I probably would have done anyway, but it meant that I had to go home and stop doing this kind of work for a while, and so I ended up being holed up in the attic of a house and wrote for 2 years or a year and a half. So I guess, and there's something about the need for hopefully not under those kinds of conditions, but the need for alternation between alternate between times of intense involvement and times of slightly more distanced reflection, I think is part of what makes survival in this kind of work possible. Very quickly, I wanted to say a few things about how it is that activist research fits well with the university in our experience here. Since that I basically came here, it's a great place to do Latin American studies, really, highly ranked anthropology department. And I came here because I thought this would be a place, at this point there was a small hearty group that I hoped to join of people that were interested in building this kind of effort here at UT. And this was really the reason I came to begin with. And we've accomplished, I think, as the group has grown, there's been something that's been accomplished. And there's, I think, a number of respects in which the fit is really good. There's really lots of ways in which continuing to do this activist research in the university makes sense and is exciting and successful. There's also a number of serious contradictions and problems. And then I wanted to suggest a couple of solutions to those problems. How are we? How are we? 5 minutes. 5 minutes. Okay. All right. Well, I'll go really really quickly on the good fit. It's I think despite all the sort of dire contradictions that Ted has laid out, one of the things that he maybe didn't say, but I think probably would agree with, or if he doesn't, he'll say so. It's very exciting kind of research to do. It's the only worthwhile kind of. Well, that's somewhat strong enough, I'm going to say it, but it's certainly a very exciting kind of research to do, and I think and that's something that keeps us going definitely. It's also a proactive response to all the critiques of anthropology and social sciences in terms of the colonial origins and the power inequalities and the problems of doing research, and so it allows you to continue to at least put your political commitments on the table and have them guide the research process. Interestingly enough, there's funding for this kind of work, sometimes under very contradictory, always in our experience under contradictory conditions, but it promises practical results, which the Academy doesn't care about, but some funders do. It also has provided a modest number of opportunities for graduate students and for postdocs, actually, to work. These are collective processes, and being collective processes, there's a lot of opportunity and need for others to get involved. And the thing that I was going to spend longer on and don't have time for, which is, I think, the most important, something that we need to work on, and actually the panel on Saturday with the three speakers that will speak then is a major, I think, chance to talk about this. It's a different way of knowing. It's a different way of generating knowledge. It's a kind of there's an epistemology of activist research, which, to quote Robin Kelly, social movements generate new knowledge, new theories, new questions. The most radical ideas often grow out of a concrete intellectual engagement with the problems of the grieved populations confronting systems of oppression. And I think that's a kind of a basic idea that useful, innovative, challenging, revolutionary forms of knowing come from social movements, come from social actors. And to the extent that we have relationships of solidarity and collaboration and common work with people in struggle, we learn more. And we also hopefully contribute to that struggle, but that's a separate question. And both are important. And I did have some examples of that but we'll leave that for now. Problems. It can be very threatening, especially when people like Mundo say, this is the only worthwhile kind of research. If you say that, you know, in your department meeting, it doesn't sit well with people who don't do that kind of research. That's why I wasn't going to say it. There's big problems with acceptance of this kind of research in the academy. It has job consequences. People don't get promoted because they do too much of this. People get fired then. Publications being more difficult if you say that you formulated your research topic not as your own kind of invention, but through a collective process. You often don't have institutional space and support within the university or recognition to do this kind of work. I think there's also serious dilemmas for training graduate students in this kind of tradition. As much as graduate students have been very receptive to and excited about our nascent activist research program, there are real issues of safety. Of can you do this and get a job? Can you do this and achieve the kind of the minimal level of quote unquote professionalization that's needed to be able to survive and, you know, in achieve the kind of modest middle class lifestyle that Mundo was talking about. And are we successful mentors therefore for graduate students because we're spending all our time doing this crazy work? Is this the right kind of pedagogy? There may well not be enough time in one's life to both do activist research and also engage the academy in a consistent way. And I think also these are two radically different work cultures. One of the things about this conference, which is so satisfying, is it brings those cultures together to some extent. But for the most part, they're worlds apart and they never meet. And so your daily life in the anthropology department no one understands what we're doing in Central America, and it's hard to explain. And the two, there's just two, it's two worlds. And there's points of intersection, but there's also they're worlds apart. solutions. 2 minutes.
Yeah.
1 minute.
5 minutes.
I don't know if we've really talked about it. I've come to believe that it doesn't make sense to try to make an argument in the academy for the political importance or the political contribution of activist research. It doesn't matter in the academy for the most part. And the only argument that may be changing, but for the most part, to survive in the academy, you have to have two different lives, two different discourses, and two different flows of intellectual production. And sometimes they meet, but often they're apart. And the only way to deal with that contradiction of the lack of valorization in the short term of activist scholarship is to do enough of the other kind of scholarship so that you're acknowledged as quote unquote legitimate. In the medium term, there's something much more radical and transformative if possible. But that the reality is, I think, pretty harsh. And that's where that alternation idea comes in. I think it's really hard to do both all the time. And so there's a need to move back and forth between the two worlds. And maybe there's even a value to having moments of reflection and then moments of intense engagement. In the medium term, and that's what this conference is about, we have to change the standards of evaluation of what we do, particularly for younger scholars, for graduate students. If there's not legitimacy in the medium term for activist research and the kinds of products that aren't recognized in the academy as scholarly, as high-level scholarly products, but are very important kinds of knowledge that's produced, if we can't get that recognized, then we'll never be able to get past a certain point in terms of institutionalizing or making space for this kind of work. And I think one of the things that's really crucial is to figure out ways for the demand for this kind of research from communities and peoples with whom we work to be heard more loudly in the university. There has to be a
a clamor for this kind of research in order for universities to be held accountable to the need for doing work that's politically engaged with issues of social, racial justice, gender equity, and various kinds of revolutionary change, if that's at all on the horizon. And I think ultimately, in terms of a strategy that we've been trying to follow, it's about being forthright and very assertive about the value of this kind of model, and at the same time acknowledging having an approach to doing this kind of work that has a kind of a pluralism to it. In other words, we don't have to, this is actually disagreeing with you there, we don't have to say that this is the only way to do research. We have to say this is a valid way of doing research, and that there's no basis on which the academy should devalue it, but rather should offer open space for it to be done along with all the other kinds, and let that struggle kind of take its course. In other words, it's a Big Ten approach rather than an approach of sort of saying this is the only way, because I think that's the only viable way to move forward. And that also means a kind of a pluralism in terms of what counts as activist scholarship, and even a kind of a openness to a rethinking of the political in lots of important ways that will not necessarily be recognized in our own accounts recognized fully in our accounts of our engagement with the revolutionary moment in Nicaragua, but will need to be present in a kind of a broadened notion of what counts as different ways of practicing activist scholarship. And finally, this is a point that comes very directly from Ted and Joy James in a recent essay that they wrote, which I very much agree with. I think one of the things that makes even minimally successful the attempt to do this kind of work is to always be willing to always have an exit strategy in mind. To always be comfortable and actually feel empowered by the idea that this is not the only place to end up, and that exiting from academia and the possibilities and even the excitement of doing something outside the institution, while continuing the struggle within, while it still seems viable, I think is a really important part of at least where I'm at now in terms of thinking about this endeavor. Thank you.
Next we'll have Joe Barrett.